Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. This is a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Friday, September 24th, 2021. I'm here with Amanda Nelson, who's filling in for Rebecca this week, who just came home to fall. It's fall there, Amanda, September 24th, there in Virginia. Don't be creepy. And it's feeling like fall. Fall reading, fall books, fall TV shows are coming on.
I'm wearing fall. A sweater.
Were you at the ready, or did you have to go dig it out, or how proximal were your sweaters?
Yeah, I figured. Yeah, I was just in Portland for 4 days for work, and when I left, it was 90 degrees. I woke up this morning, and it was 52. And we're just like, I'm just not used to that. Everyone, all my neighbors seem fine with it. I'm just like, wait, this, stop. So
I guess too, you're waiting, you're looking at the weather, right? When you're at home, you're like, okay, here comes the weather. You see it, but when you're traveling, you're not like, what's weather going to be like in 4 days when I get back home?
And so I went to Trader Joe's this morning and just kind of stood amongst the autumnal products. Some of it is weird. I'm not into some of it. Like the autumnal pasta sauce I saw. What does that mean? I don't want to find out. I don't think. Is it pumpkin? No, stop.
I think there is the, again, I don't particularly like the fall, generic fall spice blend that we call pumpkin, right?
It's not my taste,
which is fine, But it is one of those things that's funny. It's like, let's just try everything. Let's see what works. Ugh. It's like the early days of like heavier than air flight. What if we made wings out of wood? Would that work? And we're going to see what sticks here eventually here. But I'm not sure what's going to stick around, but happy fall to everyone out there. Speaking of fall, if you haven't had a chance yet, have forgotten that Rebecca and I did our fall preview draft episode as a special one-off pay what you will experiment. Go to bookriot.com/falldraft, and you can down a couple things to know about. It's a platform called Gumroad, and you can pay nothing if you're not feeling like you want to pay anything, can't afford it, it's not whatever. Or you can pay what you think it's worth, or maybe more than it's worth. That's okay, too. We're not going to tell anyone if you pay more than you think it's worth. That's totally fine. Yeah, we're going to tell each other. And there's two things you can do in Gumroad. You can stream it in Gumroad, either as an app on your phone or as the website on your computer, or you can download the MP3 and do other things with that. One of the things we've gotten feedback about is people would like to just play it in their podcatcher. And I think once we're fully done with the experiment, we'll talk about what we've learned. But there's not a super easy way to do that for all podcast players. Some podcast players allow you to drop in an MP3. Some don't. But this is the simplest way to get it out there and make it generically available. So that's bookriot.com/falldraft. We're still taking votes. This is open and available through Thanksgiving. We will be counting votes till then. So there's no reason not to go get it. I'm going to make a mention of a couple of draft-related things we get into the show today about Sally Rooney and the National Book Award long list and how poor of a job Rebecca and I did picking books. I actually ended up getting placed on the NBA long list for fiction, but so it goes. Anyway, bookriot.com/falldraft, and there is a link in the show notes to this episode, which you can find at bookriot.com/listen if you'd like to go about it that way. We're going to do a fall break. We're going to do a sponsor break, and then we'll come back and do a little bit of follow-up and get into the news of the week.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo. This is one I'm actually super excited about. I liked Leigh Bardugo's other adult fantasy books, and so I'm really looking forward to this one. It's set in the Spanish Golden Age during a time of high stakes political intrigue and glittering wealth. It follows Luzia, a servant in the household of an impoverished Spanish nobleman who reveals a talent for little miracles. Her social climbing mistress demands Luzia use her gifts to win over Madrid's most powerful players, but what begins as simple amusement takes a dangerous turn. Luzia will need to use every bit of her wit and will to survive, even the help of Guillén Santángel, an immortal familiar whose own secrets could prove deadly for them both. So The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo is on sale now. And like I said, it's a must read of the season. It's perfect for anyone who loves history, a little bit of magic, a lot of danger. You can get your copy now at LeighBardugoTheFamiliar.com. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of The Familiar by Leigh Bardugo, for sponsoring this episode.
First follow-up, Rebecca and I a few weeks ago were surprised to see pop-up shops with Sally Rooney merch in the UK, midnight openings of bookstores and anticipation of the new Sally Rooney book, and we're like, wow, that must be a really big deal. Either they're wrong or we're wrong. And I think both of those turned out to be right. In the UK, Sally Rooney new book, what's the name? I'm blanking on it. I didn't write it down.
I don't know.
Big World, something like that. I can't remember. It's the Sally Rooney book. You can Google it. That's what that thing is for. At first week sales in the UK were 46,000 copies. And I know it's hard because publishing doesn't work this way unless you have a BookScan account or subscribe to Publishers Weekly. Lucky for you, I do look at Publishers Weekly, so I have a good sense of it, though not in the UK. 46,000 for a fiction title in the U.S. is a very good, that's a very, very good opening week, but not the kind of thing you're like, oh, that means we should have opened bookstores at midnight. But here's the thing, a lot fewer people in the U.K. So in the U.S., Sally Rooney's first week sales for her new book were 40,000. So fewer than the U.K., even though U.S. has like six times as many people. So if you extrapolate that out, the equivalent kind of debut here would be like a 250 to 300,000 first week sales, which for commercial fiction slash literary fiction is an enormous number. I mean, that would be the kind of thing where you'd have some bookstores thinking about staying open late so people could come get it there. I can't think of a title of late that sold that many copies week one. I don't know what author of Sally Rooney's Stripe, and you know what I'm talking about, right, Amanda? That commercial slash literary that bridges over. I can't think of anyone that could do that. So in the U.S., she's not as big of a deal. So we were kind of right to be like, wait, that's radar seems wrong. But on the U.K., it is a much, much, much bigger deal.
I was trying to think of somebody who was a crossover for both audiences who would maybe have an equal splash. I couldn't think of anyone except Neil Gaiman and maybe Zadie Smith.
A new Neil Gaiman novel. I think that's a really good idea. Zadie wouldn't move a 250,000 units for a new novel.
No, and she wouldn't have a midnight opening either.
No, I don't think so. Gillian Flynn came to mind, and it's only because we're going to talk about her in a little bit later. Like her first big novel since Gone Girl. I don't think it would do it though, Amanda. I agree with you.
I don't know that she's as popular in the UK as she is here.
No.
I think it would have to be Neil Gaiman.
That space is a little empty for us.
I mean, it would have been Terry Pratchett, right? But that's not possible anymore.
No, I don't think so. Well, again, this is like saying, you know, if an asteroid hits the Earth, everything will get destroyed. Well, yeah, but that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah.
When the Game of Thrones book comes out, it will sell 250,000 copies.
Are we saying when? We're not saying if.
Oh, no, I'm saying if. But I'm saying if it should, that one would sell that many copies. It would sell a quarter. And people would be open at midnight.
That would be an event. Yeah.
If there were, you know, even something like the Testaments, the Atwood sequel, long-awaited TV show out. It didn't do a quarter million units in week one. I think it did 80 or 100 or something like that. Still a very good number, but it didn't have that kind of pent-up demand. Apparently the book is middling on the whole, people are saying. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm going to get around to the Sally Rooney corpus. I have read zero words or seen zero frames of adaptation of Sally Rooney, but I'm going to get around to it at some point. Do you have any mental model of the Rooneyverse?
I don't like it. I mean, I've read Normal People, and it was fine for me. I mean, it's just not to my taste. Like, I'm very much in the period of my reading life where angsty young people are boring, no matter who the author is or what. We've all experienced this angst. We've all did whatever. I'm just not. I don't care. That's just it.
Every generation needs their own angsty young people trying to figure out things, but doesn't mean you have to read all of them if you're outside of that zone. You know, you go to prom when at the right time, but to go to prom a bunch after that is kind of weird and maybe beside the point. So that was pretty interesting, but I do think it speaks to the singularity of Rooney, but also how there's not really space for that kind of blockbuster $28.99 hardback Instagrammable cover commercial / literary fiction. That space is kind of gone right now, and probably for the better. That kind of sales does suggest a certain homogeny of the cult, like a kind of focus on one title for a given week, which I think ultimately, as we've done this site for almost 10 years now, it's cool that there is no center to some degree, because you can find all kinds of stuff. The diversity in both the ways that's being used in the public, but also just in terms of genre and form and price point and format and when you can read it, has meant that it's a federation of interest rather than a focused one. So anyway, if you were excited to hear about that kind of stuff, welcome to the Book Riot podcast, where we talk about the UK sales of books we haven't read. let's see, what else did I want to do for follow-up? I guess while we're on Gillian Flynn, so there's a couple of stories that are related here about, I don't even know what you would call this. So one is about Sarah Grann launching her own publishing thing, more like a own publishing house.
Like a house, yeah.
And then Gillian Flynn and Lena Waithe starting or launching an imprint with a new independent publisher. So I don't know what to do with that either. The other thing that came across my desk this week that I didn't include here, that is a bullet point subsection C-11 to this, is Zibby Owens, who's a podcaster of some clout within a certain circle, is also getting her own imprint.
Within a certain circle.
Well, it is true. These are just all certain circles. That's all that it is. And I think these three together, three dots make a line. And the line here, I think, is interesting. What is the line, Amanda, that you're seeing if we put these together and try to connect them with a ruler, like in Hunt for Red October, to see that they're actually headed towards Thor's twins, to see where they get out of that?
Personality, like influencerness, is the connect. I think if you take Zibby out, the other two, there's like a level of kind of irritation with traditional publishing and how publishing has treated these particular authors. Like, Gillian Flynn seems unsatisfied with her experience in publishing, and so does Sarah Grant. Like, Sarah Grant's a little bit saucier about it, but both of them
very saucy. Let's come back to that in a minute, but yeah.
Okay. But if you exclude the Zibby thing, these other two seem to be like, these are big names, and they and even they are not happy with how publishing is being run right now. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, to take them piece by piece, I guess, in ascending layers of sauciness, show title. the Lena and Gillian joint with Zando feels like an extension, evolution of the celebrant, I tried to make a portmanteau, but it didn't happen. The celebrity imprint of the Sarah Jessica Parkers, the Phoebe Robinsons, the Anthony Bourdains, but extending it to sort of make explicit that they're not just sitting in a room picking books. They're going to be as part of a team that selects books, but then they're going to be part of the promotion after the book is selected in pre-production. Presumably there'll be some pre-publication hype, TikToking, talking about on podcasts or Substacks or whatever platforms people have to say, here's a book that I am handpicking from the get-go to be something that, you know, I think people should care about. And it's not just that people care about that book. People care that I care about that book. In a lot of ways, it's the glow up of the celebrity book club phenomenon we're seeing, where you can read Malala's book pick or Steph Curry's book pick or Roxanne's book pick or, you know, Reid Hoffman's book pick every week. But instead of sort of picking from what's at the grocery store, they're like, what if I had my own farm and we could decide what to bring to market? And
well,
I think
it matters that both of these are authors and not,
yes,
like Reese Witherspoon, who doesn't probably have, I mean, she probably does now, but when she started Hello Sunshine might have not have had as much of a familiarity with what that the process of making a book is like, and maybe didn't care. Like, who cares what the editorial process is like or what the marketing budgets are like or whatever. But Gillian Flynn and Sarah Grand care because it affects them personally. And so they've seen how, you know, if your last book didn't sell as well, how much your marketing budget is knocked down by X percent the next go around and all of that kind of stuff. And that's the sort of thing. It's like the very granular parts of ushering a book through that seem to annoy the two of them the most.
Yeah, I want to spend more time on the grand because I think that's actually more interesting what she's talking about. I think the other thing, to use the Reese and the Oprahs of the world, is that frankly, even having a successful imprint is small potatoes compared to selling Hello Sunshine for $900 million or the O Network or Oprah Magazine. So there's a certain level of like diminishing returns. It's a lot of picking up quarters when you get paid in hundies to some degrees to how that works. I think Gillian Flynn's an interesting middle ground because she's has big adaptation dollars and juice, and she's written TV shows, and you know, Gone Girl is, we're going to do that. You and I will have someone else join us for a Gone Girl rewatch and Book Nerd Movie Club at one time. It's worth spending some time on. Whereas Sarah Grand, because coming the other way, who came from Hollywood, it sounds like, I didn't know this. I don't know much about Sarah Grand other than by name, and I think I've read one of her books before, but she came out of Hollywood, and her sauce was the sort of infantilization of the author in the typical publishing process, where you bring your baby chick to the veterinarian and they do all the things. And you're just like, here, take my tender bird and I will just let it go. And then the vets do all the stuff and they're like, this is what we should do and here's how it's going to go. And thank you very much for bringing your bird in, but we don't need you. Can you please stand in the waiting room and we will see what happens to your bird? And I think that is an interesting, I think that's probably a true but also unfair characterization, because not all authors, A, have Sarah Grand's experience. Not every author who's working on a book or trying to pump one out every 3 years, and especially since most authors don't earn a living off their writing, they got to do other stuff. They don't want to be doing the marketing and working with Baker and Taylor and making sure the copyright is filed in Finland and all that kind of stuff. Like, it is hard to get a book out into the world. On the other hand, if that's what you want to do, if you want control, you got to take a responsibility for all the nuts and bolts. And Grant is saying, there was no affordance for me to choose to do this, right? Because the publishing process has a mental model of how to assembly line build books on the whole. And it doesn't allow for someone who really wants to get their hands dirty to get involved. So I think it makes sense. I don't know. I guess the big question is, will the results be any different, or will she just feel different about it? I have no sense of this. Do you think it would matter for someone like Sarah Grand to be like, yeah, I want to decide what my Facebook marketing budget is and what audience I'm going to target?
I think it's a terrible idea.
Why so?
Well, I do. I mean, it just has that kind of air of like, I'm Stephen King, therefore I don't need to be edited. You know what I mean? What expertise in display advertising does having written a book give you? None.
Right.
None. Like, unless you have done that yourself or run a campaign yourself. I feel like an independently, like an author who is self-publishing would probably be better at this than Sarah Grand, because they have experience doing all of that stuff themselves. Like, what does she know about cover design? Zero. I mean, who knows? Maybe she knows tons and tons and tons, and I just am not familiar enough with her. But as a model of like, give all of this creative and business control to the authors, I think it makes sense on paper. I understand why she would want it. In practice, I think it's terrible. There's a reason why these different departments and publishing houses exist. Yeah. And there's a reason why these jobs exist, because the expertise in each part of getting a book to market matters. And when she's not the first author to like have a fit about, mm-hmm. I'm just going to do it myself, or like, they didn't listen to me, or this isn't the direction I wanted to take it, or whatever. Okay. I understand all of that. And that's all justifiable, but to go off and make your own imprint because you think you can do better than people who have been doing this for years and have degrees in it and are experts, I don't know. So go with God, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, there's the hubris of any new endeavor, right? Which is that I can do something that other people aren't doing. And sometimes it's boldness and sometimes it's hubris. And I guess we'll find out, right?
We'll find out.
What did it say? Yeah, we'll find out. I think it's interesting to see, you know, Rebecca and I have long waited for the author of Juice to go out on and strike it out on their own, kind of like this. Like, mm-hmm. I'm going to make my own house and I'm going to do all, and my brand alone, my name, my backlist, whatever that I probably don't own the rights to, but what have you, mm-hmm. is going to be the locus around which I'm going to streamline, cut the fat, or just reimagine how these things work. I think it's interesting. I was reading a thing about this. I know this doesn't sound like me, but I'm interested in business. Jennifer Lopez's business empire.
Mm-hmm.
And she said some really smart things. I'm not surprised. She's a smart and savvy person. But the thing that was like the most business speak thing she says, like, I am the scarce asset,
mm-hmm.
right? Jennifer Lopez, and there isn't another Jennifer Lopez. So whatever her company is that's special leverages Jennifer Lopez. You need to be special enough,
mm-hmm.
right? You need to be special enough where there's extra value to unlock your specialness, your scarcity, that the publishing, a traditional publishing deal process either doesn't capitalize on at all or doesn't capitalize on well enough. And so on one hand, you have the Sarah Grands. On the other hand, you have like mid-list author that no one knows their name at Knopf. And then in the middle, I think you have this Lena and Gillian thing, which is a little mm-hmm. bit of both, right? It's an independent publisher, but they're not doing all the work. There's a Goldilocks situation here. I think one thing, you know, it's as we've come up on our 10-year anniversary of Book Riot, I've done a lot of thinking about what I've learned and what I know, what I haven't learned, what I've been pigheaded about. And one of the things I think is probably the naivety of a beginner is to fail to realize that some system that you think is dumb or is stupid, it may be dumb and stupid, but that doesn't mean there aren't reasons there are the way that it is, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you may not like those reasons, which is totally fair, and you may want to get your hands dirty and fix them, but there is a certain arrogant naivete to say, well, if I walk into the room with a blank piece of paper, I'm not going to make all these same mistakes all these dummies have made, right? Which, again, sometimes change can happen and should happen and has been happening. But the level to which it's harder than one might think to walk into an existing system and think that it's arbitrary and all kind of like calcified moss on a stone that just needs to be stripped away to get to the gem underneath. Mm. I don't think that's what we've seen, Amanda. I mean, does that sound familiar to you, or what would you add to that kind of general understanding of the publishing world?
I mean, who loves the publishing world as it is, right?
Yeah, right.
There, it's five multi-billion-dollar multinational corporations for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are small publishers who were doing interesting things. Why didn't you go to one of them? I don't know. Nobody, it's like Amazon, right? Nobody loves Amazon, but most people use Amazon. And nobody, I think, loves their contract with Random House, but PRH is the biggest publisher in the world. And there's a reason for that. There are probably a lot of reasons for that. And is the answer to, it sounds like she wants the best of both worlds. Like, she wants the structure and support of traditional publishing and the access it gives you to bookstores, but also the control that self-publishing gives a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very interested in how it goes. I think she needs to be a bigger name to make it actually work, but I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Just there's a little blurb link in the show notes at Publishers Weekly The quote is, frustration with the increasingly corporate culture of the new mega conglomerate publishing house and the desire to have more control over her own work, ensure it stays in print, and give other writers the same option for more creative and financial ownership of their work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Maybe. Here's the fascinating piece. The name of the independent publisher called Dreamland. Dreamland will publish trade editions, to be distributed by Ingram.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about a giant process.
Yeah.
Like, you're subject, just like everyone else, to Ingram. You have to buy paper and print stuff in China. So there's a sort of a way, like, you're going to be subject to all the same market forces. And so what's going to be different? What is this special sauce? I'd love to know what people think the special sauce is. Maybe they think, in terms of royalties, they give up too much to an FSG or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can recreate what they do with off-the-shelf tools and new technology and distribution and Ingram and whatever, and I'll give up 20% of sales, but if I'm getting 50% more royalties, I'll come out ahead. Mm. Could work that way. I could see something like that.
I think it would be more interesting if it were her plus five other authors, you know, or of the same or bigger names. Like, if a bunch of authors got together to make their own off-the-shelf kind of house, I think that would have a... Because when it's just you, then it just seems like an ego play or like a... Flounce.
Yeah, I mean, like additional 2 to 4 titles a year from other authors that aren't named. So maybe this is Fishing Expedition. She's gonna use the serum on herself to see if it turns her into a super soldier, and maybe others will follow.
Yeah.
But that is, it's one of the more extreme examples we've seen of an author that's coming from traditional publishing towards self-publishing. Usually we've seen over time the other direction of someone who has self-published and gets thrown a lifeline from a traditional publisher, you know, being grateful, right? Because they know how much it can be and there's different things that go along with it. But I think this continues to evolve. I think how much on an ongoing basis are readers going to care about celebrities and semi-celebrities telling them what books they like. Mm-hmm. I don't know how durable this is going to be. It could be the new normal. It could be. I don't know. It would be very, very new in the world of publishing in America, especially. But these things come and go. For a while, the subscription book services like Book of the Month Club, when Native Son came out in 1941, Book of the Month Club had 500,000 subscribers. So when they picked Native Son, that's why it's canon now. There were a lot of books by black authors that happened before that, but they didn't get, but, you know, Their Eyes Were Watching God came out 3 years earlier, and Wright and Hurston had a rivalry/hatred, and his got picked and hers didn't, and that's why people knew Richard Wright for the next 30 years, and Alice Walker had to go into a graveyard in Florida with a weed whacker to rediscover Zora Neale Hurston. So these models do change over time, and then, you know, we've seen over time the preeminence of the review. Right. Mm-hmm. The New York Times review at one point in time, a cover review in the New York Times Sunday book section could make a book.
Yeah.
At one time, an Oprah Book Club selection could make a book. And now L.A. Weather, which is the newest Reese pick, which I'm going to read, I'm really looking forward to it, debuted this week at number 13 and sold 4,000 copies. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge marketing budget behind that. There's ads with us. I saw it on the end rack at my local grocery store for 40% off. That's not because of Reese.
I did a podcast read for that.
Yeah, right. So, like, I think there might be diminishing returns on this thing. After Reese has picked 40 books, after Oprah's picked 50 books, after Lena and Gillian and Sarah, and I'm trying to think of other authors that are doing stuff, like Phoebe Robinson, after they've done 50 of these, after Steph Curry's 50th literary pick, are people still going to care? I don't know. I'm fascinated to see how this all plays out.
It might just be because I'm a book person to begin with, but I'm far more interested in what Gillian Flynn is going to put out than I am in what Oprah selects or what Reese Witherspoon selects, because...
Yeah.
And it was the same with Bourdain when he was alive. When Bourdain was going to be putting out food writing that spoke to his sensibility, I love his sensibility so much that I was very interested in that. I love Gillian Flynn. And so if she's going to be putting out things that are weird and kind of edgy, which is what she said she's going to be doing, then I'm interested in that. You know, like, it's just a giant blurb. An author publishing house is a giant blurb.
That's true. It's a great point. How is it different in degree or kind than a really good blurb? I don't know. That's a wonderful question.
No, it's not. It's not. It's the same thing.
Yeah, and the durability of, like, can you think of a book off the top of your head that came out of Bourdain's imprint? They're like, yeah, I wouldn't have read that without Bourdain.
Mm-mm, no.
Yeah, see? I did read one, and I'm like, that was fine. It was fine. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I read it. Am I like, oh my God, but for Bourdain, what would have happened to my reading in this book?
To my reading life.
Yeah. And I think that's the other thing, too, that as people, I've fallen subject to this as well, so I know from whence I speak, is thinking there are a bunch of books out there, but if someone else just picked them, they would be bestsellers and they would be remarkably revolutionary books. Maybe there are some. I think it was more true maybe 7 or 8 or even 10 years ago, when for reasons that were racist and sexist and ableist and a whole bunch of other prejudices, and still that's true. It's less true than it was. Like, what are the slush piles that Gillian's picking off of that the person who published her isn't picking off of? That's my question. She got published. Yeah. Did she write? Would she have written something different? I'm so curious to see. What are these undiscovered? What rocks are you looking under for these undiscovered gems that the people who do this all the time for a living and are incentivized to do a good job and sell copies aren't doing?
The point she makes in the Times article about how she's looking to give a platform to people who write like her in kind of a weird and unexpected way when you're one of the best-selling authors in your genre.
Right.
It's like, I don't understand. Okay.
Well, we saw that there was a vein of ore to be mined of the Gillian Flynn lookalikes, right? And I think we're still living in the Gone Girl shadow to some degree. I mean, Paula Hawkins, I think, has a career that she has because she wrote a book that got compared to Gone Girl and people liked it. I'm not saying that she's a fraud or anything, but like that was a thing that suddenly people wanted, and it comes and goes. It might come and go, but very interested to see how these things happen as people try to see, always trying to reinvent the wheel. And there's many things that are difficult about the wheel, but it's also better than other ways of doing it. And that's what we found over time. All right. We're going to do another quick sponsor break, and then Amanda is going to tell us about her some of your favorite books of the year and then what you're looking at for the fall. While I have you on the hook, I get to put these screws to you.
Okay. Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the like weirdest but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Where Sleeping Girls Lie by Farida Ebike-Iyamide. And if you recognize the author's name, then you know that she writes Fire, YA, Dark Academia. The last one she wrote, which was TheBomb.com, was Ace of Spades. It was a New York Times bestselling book. So in this new one, a girl new to boarding school discovers dark secrets and cover-ups after her roommate disappears. So the girl, the new girl, is Sade. She goes to this prestigious new boarding school, and on her first night, her roommate Elizabeth disappears and people think that she had something to do with it. So the more Sade investigates Elizabeth's disappearance, the more she realizes there's more to the school and the students that she realized. Secrets lurk around every corner and beneath every surface, secrets that rival even her own. Ooh, twists on twists. You already know what it is. Make sure to pick up the new book. And thanks again to Where Sleeping Girls Lie by Farida Ebike-Iyamide for sponsoring this episode.
All right. I think when Jen was on a couple of weeks ago, she also named She Who Became the Sun. So give me another 20 seconds of reification of She Who Became the Sun.
She Who Became the Sun is, by Shelley Parker Chan is It was blurbed as Mulan meets the Song of Achilles, which is a guaranteed way to get me to read something.
I was going to say, was it say, and please, Amanda, please literally read this, Amanda, in the blurb?
I know. The weird thing about it is I heard nothing about this book until I saw it suggested by my library. Like, I was in Libby.
Wow.
Yes.
You.
And it popped. Yeah, right. Which, if you've not found your way to me with a book like this, you're Mark. I don't know. Whatever. I got a lot of questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it is the most hardcore, weird, metal, like punk rock, gender bent historical fiction novel that I have ever read in my life. It might be my favorite. It's probably my favorite book of the year. It will probably, no matter what I read after, I don't know what could possibly top it. It's just so punk rock. I'm obsessed with it.
I bought it after Jen mentioned it, so I was glad to see it here because that will remind me to keep reading it. You have a nonfiction pick, which I don't think Jen mentioned any in the form of Cultish.
Yeah.
This is something that if it wasn't COVID and I was still audiobooking as hard as I am in normal times, I would have already listened to this. But I'm not going to probably do this until I have more ear time to give it. Give me your Cultish take.
Well, she's got a podcast now. So Cultish is
of course, by, right.
It's by Amanda Montell, who is a linguist. And she is talking about the ways that language forms things that are kind of cult adjacent. So we're not talking about like Scientology or NXIVM. She's talking about like Soul Cycle or evangelical churches or
MLMs,
right? CrossFit MLMs, things like that, that where people joke like, gosh, that's like a cult, but it kind of actually literally is a cult because of the way that language is used in culty ways to create in groups and out groups and like a shared vernacular and all these kinds of things. So for a linguist explaining how you're kind of like hesitation about Soul Cycle is rooted in reality was very it was affirming to me. And she has a podcast now. It's called Sounds Like a Cult. I listened to the Tony Robbins episode on my flight home, which I read a lot of business books and like self-helpy kind of stuff and have avoided Tony Robbins this entire
time. Me too.
Like, I've never. And apparently he's a terrible person who's been Me Too'd a lot and it just hasn't touched him yet. But that was all news to me. There is an episode about Peloton. There's an episode about SoulCycle and MLMs, all those sorts of things. So if you're a culty I feel like a lot of people, cults had a big moment in 2020. I don't know if it was because we were all home or what the thing was, but.
Well, when you're by yourself in your house.
Yeah, and NXIVM
like,
was
maybe
on
is
trial.
A cult a bad idea? Maybe if, is a cult better than this? Maybe?
Yeah.
I'd join anything to connect with other people.
And they were in the news a lot.
Right. That's
yeah, NXIVM
right.
is in
that's
the news
right.
a lot. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but if that's the thing you got into, as I did during lockdown, then it's a good thing.
Yeah. The opening book in a series, so if I ever get to this, it will be in 10,000 years because of O'Neill's Razor, because I won't read it till it's over, but talk to me about The Jasmine Throne.
Oh, The Jasmine Throne is the first book in a new kind of high fantasy series from Tasha Siri, and it is all based on the history and epic stories of India, and it's about a princess who is being held captive by her terrible brother, who is a giant misogynist, and one of her maidservants, who has a secret background as a child priest in a religion that was destroyed by the princess's father. So there's a lot of like political stuff. It's super gay, and every person who matters in the book is a woman, which is so refreshing from a high fantasy novel. It's very angry and Game of Thronesy in that there's a lot of like political machinations and priests and every kind of power structure that you can think of in a fantasy universe. Like, they all seem to have kind of the same basic ones, right? There's the royalty, there's the the priests, there's the like hierarchy or the knowledge workers or whatever. Like librarians, there's always like that character archetypes of power and knowledge. The people who hold the archetypal positions in this book are all women, and some of them are complicated, and everyone is morally very gray. It's just great. It was totally engrossing, and it's hard. It's brutal though. Like, a lot of bad things happen to children, which I know is a deal breaker for a
Amanda,
lot of readers.
Come
I know.
On.
I know. I'm sorry. It's rough. But right. I hate that kind of thing. Like, it's very hard for me to get through bad things happening to kids, but I still went through the whole... I still.
So
like,
you made... Because we share that, at least... Yeah. Well, I mean, I think a lot of... Listen,
a lot of people
if you,
do.
If you're into that, please stop listening and go. But there's a scale to it. And you and I think amongst our staff, have been more on the... If something bad is happening to kids, I really would like to know. So
I'd rather,
I could at least
rather,
prepare
I'd
myself
rather not.
For it. Yeah.
but it was, it got me, it had enough momentum and interest to keep me tied in through all of that. So,
and something murdery but more lighthearted, Dial A for Aunties. Mm-hmm. This had a bit of a moment for a while, it felt like, over the summer, and it seems like people like this book.
Yeah, it came out in April. It's a cozy mystery, except not a mystery at all, because Madeline, the main character, murders her, a blind date, like, in chapter one. So you know exactly who did it. The mystery is how she's going to get away with it. And the cast is her, her mom, and her three aunts. They're immigrants from Indonesia. And they own a company together, like a wedding planning business together. Like, one of them is the entertainment, one of them is the florist, etc. And when she kills this man, she calls her aunts instead of the cops, for reasons that are explained in the book. And then it's just, they have to pull off this giant wedding that's gonna you know, like, cement their business as an important company in the space while also getting rid of a body. It's hilarious. Like, what would you do if you had to hide a body with your 70-year-old aunt and then, but three of them?
Has this already been optioned by Netflix for, like, a four-part miniseries? Because it seems like it would be great fun as an adaptation as well.
It's so fun. In April of this year, just as people were, like, the vaccine was starting to get momentum, people were starting to feel a little bit better, it was a great time for a book like this to hit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's because it's exuberant of being around other people and a little more willfully lighthearted, even as it's a little bit macabre. Things you're looking forward to the fall, things we've talked about for The Sentence, The Erdrick, coming out in November. I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness. Rebecca and I had this both on our long list, Claire V. Watkins, for 10-5. What's your previous Watkins experience? Why is this one on your list?
I read her first book of short stories, The Battleborn.
It's been a while, right?
Loved, yeah. But I haven't read anything of her since. Like, I didn't read Gold Fame Citrus, but I loved Battleborn. She's got a really kind of dark and twisty sensibility, and I Love You, But I've Chosen Darkness is about motherhood, and I will read literally anything that is about motherhood from a dark and twisty perspective.
I was going to say, about motherhood with this title is also a please. It's from the Amanda Nelson books.
It's got imprint. A cactus on fire on the cover. Like, just send it to me. I'll pre-order it. I'm here for this. This is excellent. The way that I read new releases or, like, upcoming books is that I don't read the blurbs.
Same.
Like, if I try to completely avoid knowing what a book is about. So I actually have no idea what The Sentence is about. I just know that it's Erdrick, so I will read it. And aside from knowing that the Watkins is about motherhood, I don't know anything else, and I like to keep it that way. So,
speaking of things, I kind of wish I didn't know the blurb of The Matrix. It's Matrix by Lauren Groff. Do you know the blurb of this? Because if not, we don't have to talk about that.
Like, set in Eleanor of Aquitaine time.
Yes!
But that's it, and that's all I know. You're not into that.
Well, no, I am. I just, it's not what I was expecting from Groff, which is fine. Yeah. But also the name of Matrix is so, like, neopunk future oriented at this point. Because the Matrix, I mean, obviously, it doesn't have to be, but there's a literary dissonance in my mind. And I bought it in hardcover, which is a little unusual for me. I pre-ordered it because I wanted to have the physical copy so that I would kind of have to read it, because I knew that if I didn't anchor myself on it, I would drift away from it, because I'm like, but I love Groff. I want to read everything Groff writes. Does that make sense? So I'm kind of like, it's kind of leaving my briefcase in front of the door so I don't forget it when I walk out the door, make it hard for me to make a mistake here. Luckily, it's not super long. When this first came out, for some reason, I thought it was like 500 pages. I think I messed it up in my mind with the new Ozeki, which came out this week or is coming out next week, which is super long. So that was a bit of a relief. One nice thing about seeing things in print, even though I do mostly ebooks and audiobooks anymore, is I can avoid or be enticed by the length of a book.
The length,
It's for people who know and listen to the show, you know, this is very simple math, but I can read 200-300 books for the price of 1 600 book, essentially. Yeah. So, and I like to read more different titles to get exposed to different things. So this is like 250. So I could probably burn through this in a good afternoon and a half. So I'm looking.
She's an auto buy for me too. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah.
I interviewed her for Recommended, but you pour one out for our OG podcast. And she's just, like, charming and brilliant and a little sly and kind of edgy. I keep saying that, but, like, she's edgy. Yeah. She's a little bit angry. She's great. I'm so excited about it.
It's funny that you and I have Lauren. I don't have Lauren Groff stories, but when Fates and Furies came out, I did an interview as part of a couple with us, a couple other people for the National NPR Best Books of the Year, and I talked about Fates and Furies. So we both have extra special sauce on our Groff corner. And I'm glad to be surprised. I'd have to say, if you'd given me like a list of 10 blurbs to pick, probably the Eleanor of Aquitaine one would be the last one I would have expected, which is cool. And even more further afield, you and I and Rebecca were, you know, talking this week about one of the many things that makes Whitehead special. Colson Whitehead, Harlem Shuffle is out, and I'm in the middle of reading that right now, is that, you know, like a box of chocolates, you never know what you're going to get. I think this is more further afield than anything I've seen Whitehead do to this point. Like, I'm trying to think of what the Whitehead version of this, it would be like maybe, I don't know, some book set in 14th century Africa. Like, I'm trying to think of what I'd be like, whoa, Whitehead, you're really going for it. And this is how I'm feeling there, which should be exciting. This is the kind of thing I'm like, this is you getting older, Jeff. And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I'd be like, this is awesome. She's really going for it. Now I'm like, this is the Groff I want to do. I'm so set in my ways. So
I mean,
I'm fighting
yeah,
that.
Angry Nuns. I feel like that's pretty up her alley. I'm assuming they're angry.
Sure.
I don't actually know because, like I said, I don't read a lot of information about a book before it comes out. I get well. She did do that. Arcadia was historical fiction, but it was only the it was still the modern times. So
yeah, and it was debut, right? So I didn't know. I didn't have a mental model of what to expect. So it really could. If this is her first book, I wouldn't be like this out of character because there is no character. I guess right. The only thing more out of the field than Wild Nuns would have been Placid Nuns, a very quiet book by Lauren Groff about just the daily life of nuns, where nothing happens. I don't.
You get to the epilogue and it'd be like BTW. They're all serial killers.
Yeah. Right. This was all a simulation in the head of a pig or something like that. Something else weird like that. And then The Sentence by Erdrich. So maybe dwell for a minute on this because we were also having the conversation, Rebecca and I think the first time you heard us say, oh no, we've talked about this before. Whitehead is our number one draft pick for greatest living American author.
Yeah.
But then both you and I sort of said, Erdrich is interesting. It's in the next rank for sure. The Sentence also feels a little bit like a more playful version of Erdrich than we've seen before.
Yeah,
it's a murderer, kind of a mystery, ghost story in a bookstore.
Bookstore, yeah.
I'm very excited to see how this plays out. Is that is Erdrich an auto buy for you, or do you take it piece by piece?
Erdrich is too dark to be an auto buy for me. Like, it's a lot of bad things happening to all kinds of people, not just children. Mm-hmm. But I will sit on a book of hers for a while if it sounds like it's too tragic. And then
that's
wait for some.
I didn't realize I do that same thing, but that's kind of where I am too. I didn't realize that was the heuristic I'm running, but it can't be too dark. Not all of the children, indigenous children, can get murdered for me to really
exactly.
Try to feel like
yeah,
that's okay
I need to,
for
like,
me to
woo!
Spend some time with.
I will read any of her nonfiction. She's written some memoirs. She wrote The Blue Jay, I think it's called, was a memoir of her first year of motherhood, which was so good. I read that when my kids were like 3 or 4. No, I think I was in the middle of my divorce when I read that. And it was just like super helpful. The only reason that I don't pick her instead of Whitehead is that she's not as varied in genre as Whitehead. Like, Whitehead can do any song and dance.
That's the trump card he has right now over almost anybody else.
But if he wasn't doing that, or if he didn't exist, it would be her to me.
It'd be neck and neck at least. Yeah, for sure. I agree with that. Speaking of best books, best writers, the long list for the 2021 National Book Awards came out last week. I'm not going to spend too much time on the whole list because most of the time here on the show, we're talking about fiction and the narrative nonfiction, which typically is sort of adjacent to their nonfiction list. Anyway, I wanted to own that Rebecca and I, these books, a lot of these books were on our long list for our drafts throughout the year, but I think only of the 10 in the long list, I think the only one we actually picked, I think I picked Intimacies by Katie Kitamura for the summer list. The other ones are Cloud Cuckoo Land by Anthony Doerr, Lauren Groff Matrix, Abundance by Jacob Guanzon, which I have not heard of, Zori by Laird Hunt, which I had not heard of, The Love Song of W.B. Du Bois by Honoré Fanon Jeffers, which we talked about as an Oprah pick last week, The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr., which is a book I really liked, a debut black author, came out the same time as another book called Black Buck, and then another one called The Liar's Dictionary. They were all debuts I read in the spring, and I all liked them a lot, and I haven't got a chance to talk about any of them. They're not really related, except they were three debut author books I read right in a row and really liked it. So I'm glad to see it here. Intimacies, as I said. The Souvenir Museum by Elizabeth McCracken, who...
Love it.
I mean, McCracken, we don't give her much shine here. She doesn't usually make it onto our long list, but she's like... if you know, you know, kind of a writer,
she's
right?
She's a great Shirley Jackson read-alike, if that's what you're into. Yeah, maybe not as, like, creepy, but she's doing weird. There's a lot of weird stuff going on with McCracken a lot of the time.
Yeah, and as a example, this is, like, a balloon dog, balloon animal dog on the cover. Is this short stories you know? I don't know
it
anything
is.
About
yeah,
it is, which is, I think, McCracken's... that's the she wants to hit curveballs, and that's the best way to put a curveball there. Hell of a book by Jason Mott. Interesting career Jason Mott has had. His debut, I remember, got a big, huge banner at BEA like a million years ago called The Returned, which is like a YA sort of dystopian thing. Mm. He's done a little more YA. He's done some contemporary. And this book was completely not on my radar, and I have no idea what it's about, but I'm going to be looking at this very soon because he's an interesting guy who doesn't fall neatly into a category, which is maybe one reason... I haven't been on, hasn't been on my radar. And then Bewilderment by Richard Powers. Richard Powers now consistently stamping out these sort of like science-y adjacent literary novels that a lot of people really like. My dad really likes these books. I've liked some of them. I heard this one is especially good. So I think I will be checking this out. But Richard Powers, I think, has a little bit of a brand now. I think after this, the last couple... He's got a niche, and people who know Richard Powers and like the last book are looking for the next ones. So I guess notable, of course, the one I'm going to say is notable omissions or other ways. I don't get bent out of shape about this anymore. There's no book on here that I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe
how
I
dare
put that
you.
Book on here. How dare you? You're surprised not to see, you know, the Harlem Shuffles of the world or the, is the Erdrick not out? I think it's so weird, though, that... The long list for the year comes out in September.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I have something I need to put towards you here. We need to adjudicate when awards for a year come out. Like I think, as much as I don't really care for the Academy Awards, their timing makes sense to me. Your books that come out in the previous calendar year are eligible, and the award series in February. And that's it. It was only 2 months ago. The books could be on this list that haven't even come out yet. I don't think Cloud Cuckoo Land's even out yet. Like, what is this? I don't understand. This makes me crazy.
I get that from a reader perspective, but these judges have read these books. Like, the people who are making these decisions have these galleys already. They don't have to be out. You know what I mean? Like,
I understand that. But, like... One of the fun pieces, for me at least, of the Academy Awards especially is what books get recognized, or books, what movies get recognized, what I haven't seen, what, you know, what might tip me over to read something versus something else that I missed. Mm-hmm. And this, I'm like, if I can't get the book yet, other readers can't get the, what's the point of putting this list out now?
Pre-orders.
I don't understand.
I think that
pre-orders?
Books,
people
are
pre-ordering?
They're not for us. The National Book Award is not for readers.
Who is it for, though? Who is it for, then?
It's for publishers.
So they can have a sticker on the book for book buying season? That's probably what you're probably right about that. Yes. But Amanda, I don't like that rationale.
I know,
that
I know you do.
Makes total sense.
I mean, in the same way that I think as much as I dislike the Nobel Prize and things, especially these days, that might be one of the few awards that are for readers. Because... If somebody, you get a Nobel Prize, probably because you've already sold over your lifetime.
You're not trying to make your rent if you're winning a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, and like if somebody buys your next book, is it going to make a difference if you're Toni Morrison? Probably no.
No,
you know,
probably
or
not.
Even Bob Dylan, that weird, whatever, we don't have to talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be the only one that is not really publisher focused. I don't know. I'd have to think about that for a bit.
Yeah, I guess if Zori by Laird Hunt, which again, maybe this is. There's a huge following internationally or something for Laird Hunt. If that book gets the National Book Award, that's a make career. That sticker's on that book forever. It's on the paperback things. People like me, when I'm 17 and I'm trying to figure out what books to read, I'm looking at lists of winners, and I read this, just like people still buy Tinkers by Paul Harding, which is a fine book, but because it won the National Book Award, it still sells a couple hundred copies a month, which it would not be doing if it did not win the National Book Award. So I don't know. I wish there was more of an award season where the National Book Award comes out, Literary Critic Circle comes out, Independent Book Awards comes out, the Penn Faulkner. So we have a real celebration season where there could be juice behind some stuff. On the other hand, there are so many more books than movies that I don't think there'd be attention that like coalesce around, say, like No Man's Land last year, where you rack up a couple of wins. very, I don't know the last time, if it's ever happened, that something won the NBA for fiction and the Pulitzer for fiction and the Penn Award. I just don't know. Or and the NBCC. So you don't get to rack up those kinds of awards all at once, which I guess goes back to what I said at the beginning, is that reading culture is so spread out that you don't have that kind of I guess I'm of two minds. From a reader's from my perspective, I like there's a whole bunch of interesting crap to read. From a sort of news shining a light that people like me may be attracted to, the light is so diffused that it's hard to even single anything out over time. Okay. Any other thoughts about the any omissions on your docket that you were wondering, curious about? We're past the point of saying how can this thing not be on there, but anything you were surprised not to see?
No, I just don't pay enough attention to awards, honestly, anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, I make a go. Some years it's a bigger go than others at reading the long list of the Women's Prize every year. This year it was not a big go. It was a very small go. But that's the only one that I am like, I follow them on Instagram. I'm waiting for that long list to come out. Mm-hmm. I forget that the National Book Award exists along with most of the other ones. So doesn't
matter. I've said before, I think in a remixed episode I did with Trish, we're trying to come up with an Academy Awards for books. Like if we really tried to make a splash like that, the first thing that would need to happen is we need a catchy nickname for the NBAs, because it's the Grammys, the Oscars, the Emmys. Tonys, Emmys. They all have this like little diminutive. There is the NBA. Also, it has namespace pollution from the
it's already something
popular
else.
Sport in the world, or that's not soccer in the world. Also, weirdly, a little too close to the NRA for my taste, I have to say. The National Something of America is a little bit rah-rah for me at this point. So anyway, if anyone has a great idea. Yeah, right. That sounds a little bit like you're wagering on the ponies a little
you're
bit.
You're about to commit a crime.
Yeah, right, exactly. So anyway, I'm not sure what to go with there, but I'm dissatisfied, and I feel like this is talk about beginner's naivete. Why aren't book awards different? Well, I'm sure they all have reasons for doing the way they're doing them there.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HitterQuest at your local bookstore or online at HitterQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HitterQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hiro who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hiro to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hiro's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HitterQuest at your local bookstore or online at HitterQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
This last one in because you are here today. This is not a story that Rebecca and I would probably pick up on herself. Amanda is a giant American history nerd. I think you have a timeshare in Monticello. Is that you? You have a timeshare over there, right?
Yeah, I just live in the basement now.
Just in the basement. And
yelling
so,
about slavery to everyone who passes.
Yeah, all these people also own slaves. You know that, don't you? A rare first edition of the U.S. Constitution is going to auction. And this is one of those things, I never thought of the U.S. Constitution as having a first edition print run, but apparently it did. Mm-hmm. In my mind, this is a couple of quill and ink copies, and that's it. But apparently there was that, but then there was a limited edition printed. And I don't really know how one acquired one of those. Were they for the public? Were they to take back to like the Vermont State House to make sure everyone knew what they were doing or how things were going?
Yes.
At any rate, is that what they were?
Yes, they were printed to go back to be read publicly, yeah. Like in the square. So that is where they came from.
They were more like government documents. It's like getting your 401 or not your Social Security benefit statement or something
in the mail.
In the mail. But apparently there's only about a dozen of these around from this first printing. And this is the last one not already in institutional possession. Mm-hmm. And the expected price, if this were Rebecca, I would have made her play the guessing game and embarrassed her as a way of hiding my own embarrassment. Now, I would have guessed, I think, that this is probably one of the most expensive documents ever to go to auction. You know, it's mm-hmm. up there with Shakespeare first folios, you know, Da Vinci's notebooks, you know, famously have gotten sold off over time. I guess you're looking at copies of the Magna Carta might be in there. And then, of course, the Declaration of Independence. After that, I feel like it's a pretty short list. I don't know if I'm missing anything. Gutenberg Bibles, I guess, would be in there as well. Mm-hmm. And maybe some illuminated manuscripts. The Book of the Kells, I guess, is something like that ever came to market. But in terms of something that's actually printed that's not a 5,000 billion years old, this is up there. In 1988, the same copy traded hands for $168,000.
I cannot believe that.
Which turns out was a pretty good buy.
It was.
Because now they're expecting it go for a cool 20 million American dollars.
It's like if you had a house that you bought on Central Park in 1902 and you just kept it this whole time.
I know. We have friends who bought a townhouse in Greenwich Village in the 1970s when things were pretty rough there, and they've done very well. Not as well as buying this for $168,000. That's now $20 million. What else is there to say? I mean, the number is quite shocking. On the other hand, trying to buy a new Kia Sorento these days feels like I'm being held up at knife point. So yeah. I guess I'm not surprised that there's an asset bubble for this. It's in the price range of, I guess, works of art, like a Picasso. A big Picasso coming up sells for more than this because there's mm-hmm. only one of those kinds of things. And frankly, they're better wall art than the U.S. Constitution, I think. They just look more spectacular. But in terms of printed material, this is up. This is it. We're in the pinnacle here.
Yeah. And there are more interesting but less valuable items that are in the collection as well, that this like Brandon Jude's collection. Like, he has a copy of the Articles of the Confederation, which is bananas.
That's very strange.
And an official, like one of the printings of the Stamp Act. There's a copy of the Constitution that's signed by Millard Fillmore.
That's so interesting.
Which, like, I would rather have that one, I think, than the first edition. I mean, the first edition is more historically important, but Millard Fillmore is such a weird flex. Like, why
that's
did he
That's the hipster pick,
it?
Right? To have right? the Millard
yes,
Fillmore.
Yes, the Franklin Pierce signed edition of the Constitution. Were you even in office enough to read it? Probably not, but that's fine.
And I was going to ask you, if you got to have one document from American history,
ooh,
and you could snap your fingers,
the Emancipation Proclamation.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Probably because I wonder how many of those are floating around. Probably they printed up a bunch of them to send off to Texas that they didn't
to
read
Texas
or
they
listen
didn't get
to
there
for.
In time. Yeah.
But I wonder how many of those there are hanging around. Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I hadn't thought about stuff like, I was thinking there's probably stuff like, you know, Lincoln's handwritten Gettysburg Address, but that's different. Mm-hmm. This is actually a printed thing. I got to say, Shakespeare first folio would be pretty dope if I'm picking from anything.
Do you mean
history.
Francis Bacon's first folio? I'm kidding. Don't at me.
Amanda, we were having such a nice time here.
I'm not a Shakespeare conspiracy theorist. Please don't come find me on Instagram.
Sotheby says this is rarer than the first printing of the Declaration of Independence. I don't know why that would be. I guess maybe there was more of a... maybe more of a rally in the street of get your copy of the Declaration of Independence, boys, we're going to war here, that might have made that more lucrative to just print a whole bunch more of them, like you're selling those to individuals, where I don't think people were maybe like, hey, Thomas Paine, do you have a copy of the new Constitution rolling around? I don't know.
I guess it does seem a little bit more boring. Like, the Declaration of Independence, no matter who you
are,
changed.
Yeah, that's right.
The Constitution is like, so we have a federal financial system now. I kind of don't super care about that if I'm a farmer, you know, on subsistence. So, yeah, I can see how that would be.
It's like the old saying, you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. The Declaration is the poetry and the Constitution is the prose.
It's the prose, 100%.
So it's a little bit different. But very cool nonetheless. I don't know if I would have... I'm trying to think if I had not... I should have done this when I saw the headline, like, write down quickly a guess to see how calibrated or were. I mean, I certainly would have guessed 5+. I don't know that I would have gotten to 20. With not knowing how many there are. Also, I really want an American Indiana Jones. I'm tired of the National Treasure stuff and the Da Vinci stuff. I want Indiana Jones 9. To steal this out of private hands and say this should be in a museum. I really want something like this to happen. I don't know why Indiana
has to go to... Yeah, that was going to be my last point.
Yeah.
Was that this is... I don't like that they're selling it. I assume that they're expecting some institutional bids, but it doesn't sound like they're trying to position it that way. So this is, you know, just the idea of this ending up in like Elon Musk's tiny home.
I was gonna say, if Peter Thiel ends up with this and takes it to his bomb shelter in New Zealand, I'm going to be very upset.
I'm gonna vomit in my mouth a little bit.
It's not gonna be great. Though there are 10 others. And if you like the U.S. so much, you wouldn't be building an apocalypse bunker in New Zealand. anyway. All right, Amanda, thank you so much for joining me this week. You can check out all the stories we talked about. bookriot.com/listen. I'll include a list of the books Amanda had on her radar for the fall, but also her favorite picks of the year so far. You can also find a link there to the fall preview draft, bookriot.com/falldraft, but also a link there in the show notes. You can email us, podcast@bookriot.com. I don't think we had any real listener open-ended questions. I guess if I'm missing a publisher, or excuse me, an author that struck out on their own to make their own publishing house, I'd like to hear about that. And I'm not really looking for self-publishers. I know that's a very lucrative and amazing thing, especially in romance and genre. It's the really competing with the mainstream imprint kind of stuff that I'm interested in now. Like the kind of person that would be published by Crown or FSG or Hachette. Like the Sarah Grands of the world, like the Gillian Flynns of the world. Has anyone really done that in a way that has been durable over time? If you know one, or one that's failed, I'd also like to talk about that. podcast@bookriot.com. Amanda, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.